were considering last time, where you have this effective density matrix. And what we did last time was go through and work out its evolution. And we found that if we're in a limit, so here we're considering we're in a situation where you can break up the total time where you're interested in looking at the system into these little sublocks, right? Such that you had a hierarchy of scales in the following sense, right? So the average interactions that are occurring, the time scale associated with them is going to be much bigger than the length of time over which you're going to consider the evolution in each step. And in turn, the correlation time here is going to be much smaller than that as well. So that interactions in each time step are going to occur, you know, quickly in that regime. If you can live sort of consistently in that under those conditions for your system, then we found that the evolution of this this effective density matrix rho sub a, its evolution was Markovian, right? So you found that so explicitly we had the following equation. So this is a complicated expression, but the thing to notice here is that the evolution for the density matrix rho A only depends on its value at time t and not at time, and doesn't depend on its value for times previous to that.
Can you use it to remind me what delta is?
Right, yeah. So here, V bar, again, when we're in this perturbative regime, this is given by the average of your potential over the bath relative to the initial density matrix. And also this this extra this extra piece here, which is which involves these deltas. And I'm using a delta to mean the full potential minus its average over the bath relative to the additional density matrix in sector B. So that's the those are the definitions that we're using in this this evolution equation. So that's that was a setup that we discussed last time, and what we'd like to do is, you know, use it for something useful. So let's do that next. So let's look at photon scattering in some gas of particles, okay? Or fluid, or whatever you'd like. Some sort of thermal ensemble particles. So the idea is that you would have some region here containing a whole bunch of particles, which we'll label, say, by chi here, and we'll have a photon come in. And so the interaction potential in this case is going to have the form so this is the standard sort of electromagnetic interaction. So you're going to couple the gauge field to the current for these chi's. So by J mu chi, what I mean is I chi star D mu chi plus its complex conjugate. And so that's, this is the interaction that we're going to consider. And in practice, if this was, you know, a real fluid, you would have to track, I guess, nuclei and electrons. And so really what you'd have to do to do a realistic situation here is consider not just chi particles, but say psi particles as well, such that the total bath is neutral if you wanted to describe some sort of realistic situation. But here I'm just going to do one field, and so you can sort of see how things go, and you can sort of add in a second one later if you want. So again, we're going to work in this regime where the coherence times are much smaller than the time over intervals over which we're considering evolution of the photon through this fluid. And so in that limit, it turns out that these current interactions, when averaged over the ensemble, come out to be local, right? So here, if we consider the correlation between two, so here again, I'm using the same notation as before. By delta J mu, I mean the deviation of the fluctuations, the local fluctuations of J relative to its average over the thermal bath. The correlation function between these two fluctuations is going to look like a delta function in this limit, where the correlation time is very short compared to the time for evolution. And so what we're finding in this case is that if we go back to these expressions here, what we would want to do is consider what this quantity is here, right? So this is the quantity that appears in V bar. So let's calculate that. So we have the integral from t to t naught of dt prime of the thing that we have up here. So we have delta V of t, delta V of t prime. If you average this over the bath, then you're going to get something of the following form. Okay, so again, this is just from taking this expression for the correlations between the currents and then substituting it in to the previous expression over on the on the right-hand side. So this is how things would work out for these currents. So the question becomes, what's this pi mu nu function? And so we'll talk about that at the end. But let me first discuss sort of how you would solve for the evolution of the density matrix. So we can also calculate out the full V bar, right? So V bar here also involved an average of the interaction potential over the thermal bath, and so that'll come into play when we calculate the evolution equation there. So let me write out what that is. So you have so for this particular case, we have the following. Okay, so my claim is that this is what you get once you substitute into this particular expression, given the results that we discussed before. And so if we talk things through, let's sort of see what's happening here. This V bar dagger piece, you can always write V bar dagger as V bar minus V bar minus V bar dagger. and so what we're doing here is there's a commutative piece which involves just this V bar. And so that so the V bar piece is contributing here in the commutator. The anti-hermitian part of V bar is appearing on the in the second term here. So these two pieces are coming to from that anti-commutator, right? So this is so remember, if you calculate V bar minus V bar dagger given this expression, then what you do is you you pick off the anti-commutator of these two delta v's, and so that's why these two terms over here are appearing with the same sign. Okay, and so the actually you can see even more than that, right? So the first term has V bar rho a, so that's the term that has rho a on the right hand side, and then the other term is coming to you from the second piece, which has rho a times V bar.
So where did
the commutators right. So here, if I calculate this quantity here, this V bar minus V bar dagger, yeah, then this piece goes away because this is Hermitian. And so then the only thing that's left is this. Right. And so the dagger will give you a change in sign here for the I, and then you have an extra minus sign out front. So what'll end up happening is that this is this will be the thermal average of the anti-commutator of these two delta v's. Okay. So what'll happen is that the dagger will reverse the order of these two operators,
yeah.
And so that's why I'm talking about anti-commutators. Yeah. So. Right. And then this extra piece here is coming to you from the explicit integral that we have written out on the right hand side here. So I've skipped some steps, but hopefully you can sort of see that this is a reasonable thing. And so the particular system that we look at is going to have different properties, but you can see that you're capturing the properties of that system basically in terms of these two quantities here, this average of the current over the thermal bath and this pi mu nu function, which appears in the two-point correlator of these fluctuations in the current. Okay, and so again, if I was doing a so here I'm just treating chi particles. So if you assume that you're in the non-relativistic limit, all the antiparticles sort of annihilate and go away, and you're just left with particles with some net charge. And so for the system that I'm treating, strictly speaking, this J mu wouldn't generically vanish. But if you're treating a realistic system, then in that realistic system, if you average the current over the entire bath, you should find that there's no net currents anywhere and that the net charge density is zero. Basically, the fluid is neutral. And so this quantity should be, you know, zero or very close to zero for realistic systems. And so a lot of the magic comes in for this pi mu nu function. So that'll be the interesting one to discuss. But so just for completeness, though, I'm going to write out how you go through and explicitly solve this evolution equation, because here we have some dependence on rho a on the right hand side, and so we just want to write out formally what the solution is for the density matrix. And a useful way to do that is to take matrix elements of everything. So we can consider calculating a whole bunch of individual matrix elements for this density matrix. And for simplicity, let's take these wave functions alpha to be in the diagonal basis for this the gauge field operator. Okay, so that's I mean it's true that this is a gauge dependent choice, but you know, pick your favorite gauge, and then this is what we'll do. And we're, you know, we're guaranteed that the result at the end of the day shouldn't depend on what gauge we picked. So anyways, so we'll just work in some particular gauge and pick the wave functions to be eigenstates relative to the field operator for the gauge field. And if we do that, then we can sort of just go through and multiply on the left and right by alpha and alpha tilde in this evolution equation. And we can get a corresponding equation for the matrix element. And so to be honest here, I should mention that strictly speaking, since we're in the interaction picture, these wave functions here do have time dependence, right? So we assume that since we're in the interaction picture, these alphas are evolving with the free Hamiltonian for the A system. Okay, so you're minus 1/4, you know, f mu. That's the Lagrangian corresponding to the Hamiltonian that you're using to evolve this this wave function. And so if we work out this derivative now, you have to be a little bit careful because you have to also take derivatives of the wave functions. And so really, you do get a piece which has this form. But then you also get an extra piece, which comes from differentiating the wave functions themselves. And I hope, sort of given this Schrodinger equation, you can sort of convince yourself that this is the sort of thing that you would get in that case. But this term here is going to describe Hamiltonian evolution of the particular matrix elements. I'm writing it down here just so I'm not lying to you, but I'm going to sort of ignore it in what I write after this. I will point out sort of where it appears, but let me write out what this piece is here. So this is rho alpha tilde times an integral d3x of some difference in wave functions times the average of the current over the thermal bath. So that's that's the linear term, and then we're also going to get a quadratic term, which looks like this. And in a thermal system, we'll find that this pi mu nu function here won't depend on time, which is crucial to being able to integrate these equations formally here. So we have this expression for at least a part of the evolution equation. So let me just go over here and write out what you get once you integrate this. So you'll get that the matrix elements satisfy the following. So you'll have basically the product of two exponentials here. And so here I'm introducing some new notation just so I don't have to write out a huge mess in those exponentials. So here by omega, I'll start with sigma first, actually. With sigma, we mean the following. And so this is, again, the Hamiltonian evolution piece. And there'll be an extra piece, strictly speaking, in that equation, which comes from the additional contribution here, which I'm not tracking. So this is basically I'm tracking contributions from the system B right now. Okay, so there'll be Hamiltonian evolution associated with the state that you're tracking as well, and so that'll appear here in sigma. But I'm not writing it out in explicit detail. But one could compute that if you wanted to. And so the interesting part is this omega piece here. So because this is describing sort of in more explicit detail what we've been saying before. So here you can see that in general, you can get this exponential suppression of your density matrix, which corresponds to this non-Hamiltonian evolution. And finally, if you actually wanted to do something with this, say you wanted to calculate some differential scattering rate for this photon through the fluid or gas, then you could go through and calculate the rate to scatter into some particular final state by basically multiplying the result for your density matrix here by some particular final state. Okay. So this is a trace over A now of rho sub A at your final time times some particular wave function, which is describing your final state. Okay, so basically, if you want to know the rate at which you scatter into some particular final state, then what you do is you project your density matrix at final times onto that final state by computing the final wave-following quantity. Okay, so that's how I would use this to do some concrete calculation in this formalism. So that's the procedure sort of laid out once and for all. And now we can go back to the question of what pi mu nu is, right? So again, for a neutral system, normally the average of the current will vanish. But generally, pi mu nu won't. And so let me tell you just a little bit about what's going on there. So here, I guess, we have to calculate a thermal average. And so so let me tell you the result, and then we can talk a little bit about where it's coming from. So for a thermal ensemble, you'll find that the result is the following. So here, n squared is the so n is the number density for chi's in this fluid. Kappa sub t is something people call the isothermal compressibility. So this is one of these quantities that you derive in your StatMet class using the grand canonical formalism. So that there's some explicit expression here for what kappa t is. If you the name is suggestive, actually. So let me write down the formula first. But the idea is that if you make some change in the pressure on the system, kappa basically measures the amount by which that system compresses. So it's tracking the relative rate of change of the number density as you change the pressure. Okay. And so this quantity will be different for different for different fluids. But one that's easy to do, I guess, is the case that you know a lot about, right? So one thing that we can always calculate is for a perfect gas, right? So there, you know that PV is equal to nRT, right? Or if you pick nice units and intensive quantities, then you can write it just as P is equal to little n times T. So normally what you can do is normally you say PV equals NRT, but if you don't talk about moles, you just talk about actual molecules, then you can trade that R for a K. And here, what I'm doing is dividing through by the volume. So that's what that's why I'm writing the number density here rather than the total number of chi particles. And if this equation is true, then you can see that del N by del P at constant T is just going to be 1 over T, right? And so that means that for a perfect gas, we find that pi 0, 0 is equal to just N, where N is the number density. So the idea is that you're plugging this in here, you got 1 over NT for kappa, and that's going to cancel out one of the N's and the T here in the numerator once you substitute in. Okay. So that's how things work for a perfect gas. Now, getting this result is something that takes a little bit of time, but for completeness, I can sort of just give you the quick story about how that works out. So when we're calculating this thermal average here, let's just focus on the 0, 0 component. So what we're doing really is we're calculating so the zeroth order component of the current, it tracks the number density, and what we want to do is calculate the thermal average that over system B. And so strictly speaking, what we're doing is we're taking the following trace, right? And let me just remind you of what rho B naught is. Again, if we're assuming that this is a thermal system, then you can describe this using some Boltzmann factor. So the density matrix is given by that expression, where Z is the grand canonical partition function. So this is the trace of the exact same operators I wrote above there. And so the idea is to sort of just plug this in here and explicitly take the trace. But the nice thing here is that we can also consider taking, so the same quantity, so here, this operator here is the number counting operator, and really what we want are number densities here. So let me be a little bit careful. So before, my notes, I was writing this as volume, but I realized that there's already V's on the board for potential. So I'm just going to call this L cubed, assuming that you're in some box with or cube box with side L. So really, what we want is this quantity, sort of, locally within the system. So the idea is that we're imagining sort of breaking up this total fluid into small boxes, and within each one we can compute this thermal average sort of consistently. So if we do that, then we can imagine sort of just differentiating with respect to mu here in order to bring down some factors of n, or nb, or let me just drop the sub b there for the n. And so we can go through and do that. So we can imagine writing this as the following, right? So if we Let's see if that makes sense. Or I guess really what we want is the ln of z. And so as you take the derivative of the logarithm, then so we have to be a little bit careful here. So this quantity really is going to end up giving us n squared minus the average of n squared. Okay, and so in the case where this average vanishes, then we're perfectly good. But it turns out that really what we're looking at up there is the variations, anyways. And so remember, there's a story that if you're calculating the variations over the average, then you can imagine thinking that is the average of the square minus the square of the averages. And so really, strictly speaking, the quantity that I'm computing here on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, is not really this. It's the variations. And that's okay, because that's what we really wanted anyways. So the reason why I'm talking this through a lot here is because you have two derivatives. And when you take the first derivative, you're okay. So you'll just get 1 over z times the trace over b of rho b 0 times 1 of the n's. And the purpose of the second derivative is to come in here and pull down a second n. But in the process of taking that derivative, you'll also hit the z, and that's what gives you this minus average squared term. But turns out we want it there anyways, so this is the right expression for everything.
When you started off with on the left-hand side,
yeah.
Are you saying that right from the beginning, what you meant to write was the variation in n, or are you saying that we've derived that expression is actually equal to the variation?
Nothing that I've written here is strictly wrong. It's just I'm taking a shortcut here by skipping over the process where I actually go through this derivation explicitly. Maybe it wouldn't.
No,
I could just write a couple more lines here,
and you
can
say, okay. I'm absolutely comfortable with that. I just don't understand what we've. Okay, because if you like, what I'm getting at is you went through and you like you started with nx prime. Average,
right? Yeah,
and then you said that was equal to some trace, and then on the right hand side you manipulated that to get okay. So this is really just like the variance in n.
That's right.
Yeah. Right, but couldn't you have just gone right from the beginning where you wrote nx and just said okay, so this is just the variance in n.
Right. Yeah. So what I would have done, you know, if what we would have found if I did things the long way is I would have. Because you know, I was dumb when I was writing my notes. Basically, what you do is you calculate this quantity first. You find that it's some complicated derivative, right? Because you have to work hard to cancel off the piece that you don't want. But then what you really end up calculating is not just this quantity, but this quantity minus the average squared. And it turns out that average squared goes through to cancel out that extra quantity that you sort of rig up to cancel out the fact that you have this extra piece coming from taking the second derivative. And so the short way to explain that is just to say that if you take two derivatives here with respect to mu, you're really getting the variance from the get-go. And so written as such, this is true so long as you trade the n's for delta n's here on the left-hand side. So I agree that I'm cheating. I should I was hoping to save a bit of time here, but I mean we could go through the derivation if you want. I think you can sort of see how it would play out from here, right? So one of this mu derivative will take will bring down a second n here on this piece, but then you also have to take the derivative of the z, because the z has some dependence on mu as well. And when you do that, that gives you this extra piece here. Yeah. So basically I'm making two, you know, mistakes and sloppiness on each side of this equation. They're sort of canceling out. So really it's delta n that appears on the left-hand side. And here, really, you don't have to correct anything. Really, it's just a second derivative with respect to mu. So that's the expression we have. And the rest of the work is just sort of rearranging what we mean by this second derivative with respect to mu of the log of this partition function. And in the grand canonical formalism, it's usually you can do some useful things if you write instead of this whole trace every time, you can define some quantity which is so let me what's a good name for this? So let me call it so I'll make it an intensive quantity here. So I'll pull out a factor LQ just for convenience. And I'll call this little omega. And so this is the intensive version of what you would call the Landau potential, usually, in if you're doing the grand canonical formalism. And this is related to the Helmholtz potential by the following equation. Okay, so normally, so this is the usual sort of Legendre transform story that you would do in thermodynamics. So here again, F is defined to be your real potential minus a TS term. And here, or maybe, you know, this is a potential energy density. So these are all intensive quantities. I'm dividing through by some volume here everywhere. But this is the same sort of game that you would play for the Helmholtz potential. And so the corresponding story in the case of the grand canonical formalism is one where you subtract off this mu n instead. And it turns out that this quantity, if you go through and work out what it is, then it's just minus the pressure for this system. And so that's convenient. What that means is that we can say that the we can say that the logarithm of Z is equal to minus beta L cubed times minus the pressure. So this is pressure over temperature with an extra volume factor. And so if we take this expression and substitute in here, then we find that delta n when thermally averaged is going to give you just let me see here, beta L cubed del squared P over del mu squared. Right, yeah. Might be a little bit easier to see if I just leave this as beta. But yeah, that's right. And so the last little bit of rearranging can be done by working out these differentials. So if you work out the differential for omega, you find that d omega is equal to minus s dt minus n d mu, and d omega is minus dp. So if you play this thermodynamics game, then what you can do is read off from here that if you calculate dp, let me write it here. So if you write out dp by d mu at constant temperature, sorry, it shouldn't be a little t, it should be a big t, then that's just n. Okay. And so this the second derivative here, you can write as dn by d mu. And I think we're done now. Oh, not quite. No. Right. So what we really, if we want to substitute in for kappa t is this quantity here, which we're writing as dn by d mu times d mu by dp. Right. So we should be finding that this is 1 over n squared d squared p by d mu squared. So let me see. Right. Okay. Yeah, I think we're in business, right? So the idea is here, you put this quantity in here for this derivative, and that gives you the 1 over n squared. And then the dn by d mu is the d squared p by d mu squared. And so once you make that substitution here, then you get this is n squared over beta l cubed times cap sub t. And we're happy that there's an l cubed because there is a dangling integral over the volume, which appears here. And so that, so let me point specifically to where I mean. Let's see. So these, I think these j's would have came with two. If we were calculating this quantity here, there's a leftover integral over the volume, which appears. So that'll cancel out the extra factor of L cubed that we have, which is in the equation down here. I think that's how things work out. But it may be that I forgot to cancel that out here somewhere. So let me so the so this is a whole long song and dance to convince you that this extra quantity here that appears at the quadratic level can give you evolution into a mixed state, given that your compressibility for the fluid that you're scattering off of is non-trivial. And so that's the basic story for the case where you're scattering through a gas. I might as well switch gears and try to set up the discussion for in the afternoon. That's it for density matrix stuff. The goal for the afternoon is to discuss scaling and non-relativistic Lagrangians.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Question.
Yeah.
So you go from I'm trying to different. So you have 1 over n dn dp, right, for kt,
mm-hmm.
And then you're taking the derivative with respect to what on the bottom?
Here?
What's that variable?
Yeah, sorry. This is a mu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, so you just came up with potential?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So right. So the goal is to eventually write everything in terms of kappa t, because that's the thing that experimentalists can measure easily. Okay. So let me, with the time that we have left, let me just switch gears and talk a little bit about scaling in a way that maybe that overlaps with what you saw before with Cliff. But the goal is to sort of set up a discussion for non-relativistic systems. So let me do that now, and then we can go to the non-relativistic case in the afternoon. So let's look at we're going to start off from a relativistic Lagrangian for a scalar field, and we're going to work out what the corresponding non-relativistic Lagrangian is. So we're going to start off with the standard thing that you would have for relativistic real scalar field. And we can keep a number of sort of higher order terms. So I won't write down everything, but I'll just give you a sense of how you would go through to systematically work out which ones you'd want to keep. So this should be a coefficient d m to the 2n d phi squared phi to the 2n. And here we're assuming that we're summing from 1 up to whatever you'd like. And you can also keep other higher derivative terms if you wanted. But this is sort of the general sort of catch-all for the types of higher order operators that you might expect. And just so we're clear, I'm using this contracted notation. So by d phi squared, I mean d mu phi, d mu phi. Now this is all sort of set up assuming so the action is going to take the standard form as a integral of the Lagrangian. What we can do is imagine doing a Fourier transform here. So if we do a Fourier transformation here, then we can ask some interesting questions about scaling of operators. So let's do that. So we're going to imagine that just that I'm being honest here, we're going to do a Rick rotation so that I can think of the four-dimensional volume as sort of being the product of four lengths. So let me just, for simplicity, think of the four-dimensional volume that we're going to get over as some length to the fourth power, where we're taking L to be defined relative to some particular wave number k. And if you go through and compute this integral, my claim is that you get the following. So you'll get a factor of 2 pi over k to the fourth, which comes from the volume integral here. And then basically wherever you had a derivative before, you'll get a k now. And wherever you had a phi field before, now you'll have phi sub k, which is going to denote its Fourier transform. So here, now, in this case, you would have this for the kinetic term. And I'm going to track all the higher derivative terms here just for completeness. So if you write these out, you should get the following. Check something here for a second. Right. Now, I think there's an overall factor of m to the 2n missing here. I think that would make everything work out okay. But I guess so let's be careful here. So I think that's, sorry to be changing things on the fly here. I had done things in a sneaky way before, and I think I just need to be careful. So I think this is so I'm missing some extra factors of k squared out here, up front here, I think. So yeah.
Is there y?
The, oh, sorry, I wrote down the wrong line. My bad. Yeah, these shouldn't be there. Yeah, sorry about that. Getting ahead of myself here. So let's get rid of that hat too. So that's right. And I think that looks right. Right, because now you'll get 4 plus 2n, and then 4 plus 2n here once you do the Fourier transform. Okay, good. So I think we're in business. And what I'd like to do now, though, is look at the kinetic term and ask how would you want to scale k and phi so that kinetic term would be invariant. And so the idea is that if you take phi sub k goes to c times phi sub k, then that gives you a c squared in the numerator here. And since you have an overall factor of k to the fourth out here in the volume factor, then it turns out you would want to scale k goes to c times k in order to keep the kinetic term invariant. So the idea would be that the numerator scales by c squared, and the denominator would scale by c squared as well, because you have an overall 1 over k squared in the denominator. And so that would make the kinetic term invariant. So that implies that you can define an invariant quantity phi hat sub k, which is phi sub k over k. And so now what we can do is go through and rewrite everything in terms of this phi sub hat and see what the action looks like in that case. You'll still have 2 pi here in the volume factor. This is why you have a k squared now. So the idea being that as you trade phi for phi hat, then you'll grow these extra factors of k, and 4 of them will cancel with the volume factor, but all the additional ones are being tracked here. So I'm not sure if you guys did a similar sort of thing in close part of the course, but this is one way that you can sort of see which operators are going to be relevant, marginal, irrelevant as you go to low energies. So the idea is that as you dial down to low energies, that's like scaling k to be very small. And in that limit, this mass term here will get enhanced. This phi to the fourth term remains unchanged, but then all these higher order operators become suppressed. At low energies because of these factors of k squared which appear. And but the scaling that you read off is defined as relative to phi hat. So basically relative to a situation where your kinetic term doesn't scale. And this is going to be important for us later on, because what happens as you go from the relativistic to the non-relativistic case is that there's this cancellation that's happening in your Lagrangian all the time between the quadratic term in your time derivative operator and the mass term. And so in order to get rid of that cancellation that happens, it's convenient to define a field psi in the following way. So the idea is that we're going to take out a fast phase from the field phi. So I can write this out. So this will be the substitution that we want to do on the system in the afternoon. We want to basically redefine phi so that we take out a very fast phase from it. In the case where the energies are small compared to the mass of this particle, that's the non-relativistic limit. And the idea is to just get rid of this fact that there's this quickly oscillating. Yeah, that's right. Sorry, my writing's a little bit bad today. But that's right, yeah. And so the idea is that we're working in the limit where the n is winning here, right? So basically, everywhere we look, we've got this extra factor of mass sitting everywhere in our energies. And by taking out this fast phase from the field phi, we can essentially just subtract off that contribution and look at the stuff that's relevant to non-relativistic physics, which is depending on this this nest leading order term here in the energy. And so that's the substitution that we're going to do in the afternoon. And we can read off what the corresponding scaling will be for psi now once we do the substitution. And we'll find that you'll need some very particular scaling between the time and space derivatives in order to get everything to work properly. And so that'll mean that the rules that govern what operators are marginal, relevant, irrelevant, will change once you go to the non-relativistic limit.